Wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today in our program, Fran Michel discusses the recent success of Oregon's Reproductive Health Echo Day Act, which will ensure that Oregonians, regardless of income, citizenship status, gender identity, or type of insurance, have access to the full range of preventive reproductive health services, including family planning, abortion, and postpartum care. Desiree Hellinger's interviews Don Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the Portland Police Bureau's new draft policy on the use of force. The PPB issued the draft on July 1st, giving the public a two-week window to respond to a lengthy document that threatens to weaken existing requirements for documenting lethal police shootings. I'll conclude today's program by sharing an article, Justice Denied on Trump's Muslim Ban, by Mukun Radi. Radi looks at the cruel and bigoted reasoning behind the Supreme Court's restoration of parts of Donald Trump's Muslim ban and argues for resistance. Leading off today, Bill Resnick interviews Richard Smith, a China expert who has written a lot on China's explosive politics and economic development, including his books include China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse and Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And now he's finishing a book on China and the environment. The provocative subject of the interview, Can China Save What Is Loosely Known as Civilization? Bill?
Hi, Richard Smith. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Richard Smith is a China expert. It's explosive politics and economic development. He's written a lot, including China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse and Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. He's now finishing a book on China and the environment. Richard, Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Accord. Immediately after that, China and Germany announced that they would assume leadership of the planetary response to climate change. These two countries positioning themselves as the leaders of the international community in saving the planet. So, Richard Smith, what do you make of Paris, the U.S. pullout, and whether China can save what is loosely known as civilization?
Chinese civilization, yeah, a police state civilization, yeah, right, great. Well, Bill, there are a number of issues raised there. I don't quite know what to say about Trump's pullout and the effect of the U.S. just yet, but I'll say something about China, which is that Xi Jinping is trying to project China's image as a normal country, and particularly he's able to make that particularly effective message against this buffoon we have as a president in this country, so that's nice. But in fact, the chances of China leading any kind of move to prevent climate change are remote. And that's because for a number of reasons. But first of all, in China, the government has to maximize growth in a way which is kind of beyond capitalist rational in the West. And that's kind of the subject of my book on China. The point is that China has a collective ruling class. It's a party bureaucratic ruling class, and it makes it very difficult for them, for leaders like Xi Jinping, who has very good reason. Lots of people in their government have very good reason to want to cut coal consumption and so forth, particularly coal, but fossil fuels in general. However, they cannot do so very much because there is tremendous resistance in the system to that. That's one reason. And secondly, because Xi Jinping himself is meeting China's maximizing growth effort with all kinds of programs to create sort of innovative industrial development in China, make China relatively self-sufficient in high tech, and to push China to the leadership of, he wants to make China explicitly the technological leader of the world economy. He has a program called the New Silk Road Initiative to bring some 60 governments in Southeast Asia, South Asia, and all the way to Europe into a trade alliance with China, in which China will be able to sell them all kinds of infrastructure and so forth like that, in return for, largely in return for extracting their minerals and forests and this sort of thing. So what you have in China is a kind of excessive growth model based on the needs of the bureaucracy, which are twofold. First of all, it was originally a communist party, and it has a need to maximize employment in a way which capitalist countries don't. Like in the West, you know, there are masses of unemployed people. Companies lay off workers. That's not the company's problem. It's not even the government's problem, unless it's an emergency like the Great Depression. It's not really their problem. But in China, this is a problem. The Chinese government cannot allow masses of unemployed people to exist in China, and therefore it makes every effort to get them reemployed when they get laid off by companies, either by state companies or private companies. The government makes huge efforts to make sure people are employed, even if that means having them build stuff that nobody wants. Like they produce steel, overproduce steel, more than China can use. Like they produce 30% more steel than they can consume, even China can consume. And they dump it on the world market at below cost. Well, why is this rational? It's rational because, and aluminum too, and many other commodities like cars and so forth. And why is this rational? It's rational because in that system, you need to keep people working. It's better to have them making steel and aluminum that just sits getting piled up. There's a huge pile, like 6% of the world's production of aluminum ingots is sitting in a desert in Mexico. They tried to sneak it into the U.S. because there are quotas on Chinese aluminum imports. So they parked it in Mexico, trying to sneak it in as Mexican production. Moved more in Vietnam, same deal. And they dumped steel in the world markets at below cost. It may be irrational. No capitalist company would do that. They couldn't justify that to their shareholders.
And they're building cities that nobody wants to live in. So you have vast numbers of apartment towers all over the country that are uninhabited and just sort of decaying.
It makes sense for the government to keep people employed, whether they're producing steel or aluminum or ghost cities. I mean, right now, there's in plans and in construction homes for 3.4 billion people in China. That's what's on the drawing boards and what's under construction right now in China. There are only 1.3 billion people in China. Apartments have become just a source of investment, speculative investment for the middle class in China. And it makes sense for the government to promote the middle class to keep them happy, to find some, because they can't invest their money out of the country. That's difficult for them, although many middle-class and upper-class people are trying to get money out of the country illegally, but that's difficult to do. So they plow their money into buying apartments. So most middle-class families in Chinese cities, or many, have three or four apartments. These are not vacation apartments. These are not, they're not, nobody's going to live there. They're just speculative investments, as much like you would put money in the stock market. They put money in the stock market, too, but the stock market is very limited in China. And it's really not really a stock market. It's kind of a toy stock market, but that's another subject. Anyway, so it makes sense for them to keep this over-construction going and also to move out and sell this stuff, sell their commodities, their excess steel and all their plastic junk and whatnot to Africa and Asia and so forth like this, and push this overproduction outside and also push their employees outside. There are like more than a million Chinese have migrated to Australia and another million to Africa, at least a million. And the big state-owned industries go to these countries and they sell infrastructure projects in Africa, for example, to build railways and dams and power plants and this, that, and the other, and open up mines to extract minerals to ship back to China, and also building a steel plant here and there in Africa to produce steel on site. So they're pushing their overproduction out of the country, and they're pushing their workers out of the country because there are too many workers and too much infrastructure construction in China. It's just so massively overbuilt already. They've overbuilt not just the cities, but the dams and the highways. They have a huge highway system, express highway system, much larger than the American interstate system. But, you know, half these highways are empty because outside of the big corridors around Beijing or Shanghai or Guangzhou, places like that, there are highways all over the western part of the country. They're empty. People dry their crops on them. But it's useful to keep people busy to build this stuff.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on cable radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Richard Smith, who studies the development, the explosive development of the Chinese economy. His thesis is that that China cannot possibly be a world leader in saving the environment, in that they are a state that survives and a communist party that survives through the mechanism of continuous and eruptive and enormous growth, including the smelting of enormous piles of metal just to keep people employed, as well as ghost cities all over China and highways on which nobody drives. And furthermore, as you pointed out earlier, they are now doing a program of rural automobile expansion, trying to get rural people to buy more cars and then to create even more highways, at least local systems. So China is not going to stop, and they're doing it with coal, but even if they tried to do it with solar, I mean, if they substituted for their coal plants huge solar and wind turbine plantations, which they are doing at some level already, they are just hooked into growth, 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 and stimulating more extraction of materials and more pollution.
Yeah, more useless consumption. I mean, China, it's, so far as the renewable energy sector goes, China is the world's leading builder of wind turbines and solar panels. It also leads the world in installed capacity, solar and wind. And yet, wind power accounts for less than 4% of power generated in China, and solar barely 1%. Why is that? Well, that's because the collected ruling class of China includes huge ministries, the coal ministry, the railway industry, the oil ministry, and so forth. And these ministries have millions of employees, and they have those vested interests to deal with. So Xi Jinping may want to promote renewable energy, and he does. And in fact, people are happy to build these plants all over the place. But it's a very fragmented economy because of the nature of the way the system was set up in the 1950s.
Not to mention the fact that they're building up their army, and the army itself has millions and millions and billions of workers in it. And Army ministry is also interested in growing and growing.
And the thing about coal, to kind of come back to the U.S. and so forth, and the larger question about energy consumption, is that coal and oil are available 24/7, wind and solar, not so much. So it's a problem for any country, even Germany or the U.S., because of the sporadic nature of power production and the inability so far of energy producers to come up with a tech solution to energy storage.
Well, storage is getting a lot cheaper as well, and when the Chinese get into it, it will get even further cheaper. That's my hypothesis, at least.
That's possible. But then the larger question is, well, what do you use this energy for? If you just use more electricity, free, non-polluting electricity, doesn't that just, on the Jevons principle, just encourage more consumption of electricity, in particular for production of stuff that people don't really need, you know? We have an economy, a capitalist economy, of endless invention of trivial junk that no one really needs, whether it's 3D printers or hoverboards or drones or the latest next thing, you know, as the Lorax used to say, the next need.
H-N-E-E-D. And always, of course, McMansions after McMansion. This is for the top 40%. There's a lot of people in this country that are perennially, constantly hungry and without medical care. But that's a whole...
Right.
That's another story. But the privileges of the industrialized West make for enormous amounts of consumption of everything, and of China and parts of Asia. I have a hypothesis. China is not going to change, but the world is going to change. If you believe the climate scientists, and I do, and I know you do, we're going to begin moving, and right now we're already there, and it could be very soon, an enormous climate crisis, one cataclysmic storm after another. And at some point, when Long Island is under the waters, and much of South Florida and Louisiana, not to mention the California coast, much of parts of China, Bangladesh, all the low-lying areas, and there are many of them in Southeast Asia, the destruction and then failures of production of food, all of that is going to hit. And if it's not too late, it seems to me there will be a mobilization. People will wake up. There's going to be a mass support for, in fact, doing something about it. It seems to me right now we're in a position where it seems inevitable that climate cataclysms are going to occur. Inevitable is too strong a word, but very likely. It seems to me that the cheapness of solar panels and wind turbines, and the fact that there are lots and lots of small producers and small installment companies who are now working, or enterprises rather, some are co-ops, who are working in lots and lots of cities now, and some in California even, where you're getting these local energy grids such that you could have enough energy to run a successful society, even modern society, if you really cut back on production of useless stuff enormously. It seems to me that's the hope of the future, is that at some point the mobilization will occur, and the mobilization and the left will lead it rather than a corporate right, which is possible. They'll be contesting for power at that time. That's my hypothesis. Why don't you comment on that?
Well, the basic problem we have in capitalist economies everywhere around the world is that in order to do what we need to do to save the humans, to save the planet, means that we have to take actions to suppress fossil fuel consumption, and not just fossil fuel production and so forth, but consumption, all the industries that are based on fossil fuels. So you're talking about autos, airplanes, airlines, tourism, chemicals, plastics, construction, and on and on and on. If we need, scientists tell us we need to suppress fossil fuel consumption to almost zero by 2050 if we hope to prevent global warming spinning out of control. And the only way to do that is to suppress it. But if you suppress it, that means you're talking about throwing millions of people out of work, not to mention making a lot of capitalist investors unhappy. So even if you could get around the problem of the capitalist investors, you have to have a plan for the workers. So what do you do when you cut back production and lay off masses of people? That's why every year there are climate negotiations, but they always end up in acrimony and collapse, because no government on earth will accept a decline in the rate of growth in order to save the planet. So if we carry on at this pattern for the next few decades, then it'll just be too late. So what I argued in my Green Capitalism, The God That Failed book, and articles and so forth, and also in China, is that what we need is a radical, significant deindustrialization. We need to close down all kinds of industries that are polluting and over-consuming resources and so forth. But the only way we can do that is to create a different kind of economy, an eco-socialist economy that can actually provide jobs for people. It's not good enough to just tell the workers, well, you need a job training program for a few weeks, and tell coal miners and oil workers, go get retraining for a while and become a computer jockey. Good luck on that. That's not working in China any more than it does in the U.S. What you need is an economy that can actually provide people other jobs, guaranteed jobs, at reasonable remuneration, comparable to what they're getting. Otherwise, if you don't have an economy that can do that, then people will unavoidably, necessarily, keep pushing to keep their jobs at the expense of the environment. In other words, they will keep destroying their children's future to hang on to their jobs today. This is just completely insane. More and more people understand this, but under capitalism, they don't have a choice. So the only way to give people that kind of choice is to propose creating a different kind of economy, not a capitalist economy, but nationalize and socialize the big industries and dismantle, repurpose them, reprioritize them, close down the ones we have to close down, and take those resources and put them into other things we do need.
Richard, I think that's right. But how do we get to that point where we have the power to take over, nationalize, that is, take over those industries to change things very radically, as well as the cities, and provide jobs with people? And it seems to me that World War II in the United States provides some example when we did, in fact, nationalize the auto industry. There were years when none were produced. All they were producing, of course, was tanks and planes and all the rest of it, war armaments. But they could have been producing clean energy devices, and all of the other industries under public control would be forced to radically cut back, and workers would be employed in reconstructing the infrastructure, that part of some of which would be destroyed, and repurposing the infrastructure and repurposing all of our productive facilities, as well as, of course, agriculture, very radically changed. It does seem to me that the point at which we can imagine that transformation is when people wake up to the threat. And right now, they're passive, basically, on the environment. But when cataclysms occur, hopefully before the climate crisis becomes absolutely irreversible and the world starts baking to death, it seems to me that's the mechanism through which we could imagine the kind of reconstruction that you were talking about.
Well, I would say, yeah, you're right. I honestly don't have a clear strategy, and I don't have, you know, any sort of crystal ball. But what I was just saying is that the left has a responsibility to project a vision of an alternative possible society and to fight for every democratic kind of change that we can do to democratize whatever we can. I just see the strategy has to be the most radical democratization, getting people's control over the economy and society as much as they can, because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for an end and means which are the same. That is, we want to get to a democratic, bottom-up, planned economy, and we need to do that through democratic means. And I just think, yeah, people will see the need for change, but people on the left need to projecting a radical alternative vision of a possible, plausible eco-socialist society, because otherwise people don't know what to fight for. If nobody's putting out any kind of alternative vision of a different kind of society, then what's the point of fighting? You may as well go on with capitalism. That's my sense. And
right.
You know, I'm trying to, I put my little 2 cents into that and in my Sixth Theses paper in the next project, Sixth Theses on Saving the Planet. So people might look at that. That's my own modest contribution, but there are lots of other people who are contributing to this.
Right.
I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah, Richard, it seems to me what you're describing is in fact being modeled now in some places in the world, and more, it seems, in some of the cities, as in California, where there are, where those possibilities at least are arising and people are beginning to see it. I think that's the great hope. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Oh, you're certainly welcome, Bill.
Right, so long.
World, planet, poor old species, as climate change will get worse. Poor old nature, poor creation, I think you've been cast by a curse. But I don't want you to die, I can see all the lies. There's nothing there that's new. But it isn't too late to get hold of our fate, and you know what I say is true. And meanwhile in the mansions and manors with style, they're praising the progress and growth. And the leaders we need are indeed paralyzed, and carving there's no other road. Poor old forests, poor old farmlessness, climate change will get worse. Poor old waters, poor old world, I think you've been cast by a curse. But you know that it's true, there is so much to do, it is no good to lie down and cry. And the day that you see, that's the day that all of your sadness and sickness will die. For the wealth we are building while wasting this earth is only causing us pain. It's disguised itself well as progress and growth, but destruction is still its name.
That was a song called Poor Old Planet, unattributed on YouTube, so I don't have any idea who that was. Next up, Fran Michel discusses the recent success of Oregon's Reproductive Health Equity Act. Fran?
Fran Michel here with some good news for a change. The Oregon legislature has passed the Reproductive Health Equity Act, which will ensure that Oregonians, regardless of income, citizenship status, gender identity, or, with a few exceptions, type of insurance, will have access to the full range of preventive reproductive health services, including contraception, abortion, and postpartum care. This victory offers important lessons about how to continue making gains for equity and empowerment in the face of the national government's push to the right, and the law offers important ground for building toward further health equity, including single payer. Although the Reproductive Health Equity Act, like the Affordable Care Act, includes an exemption for religious employers, it largely moves counter to the trend in many other states and at the federal level to restrict access to reproductive health care. With this bill, Oregon will become only the second U.S. state, after California, to require private insurers to cover all abortions. In contrast, 25 states restrict abortion coverage allowed in plans offered through their state insurance exchanges. And funding is only one method of restriction. Just this year, according to the Guttmacher Institute, legislators in 28 states have introduced 88 measures that would ban abortions completely or under certain circumstances, while another 5 states have already adopted 10 major new abortion restrictions. The federal government, since the 1976 Hyde Amendment, has prohibited using federal funds to cover termination of pregnancy, except in cases of rape, incest, or endangerment to the life of the mother. The common exception for rape, of course, helps reveal that the driving concern in controlling access to abortion is less the purported life of the fetus than it is the right of women to choose to be sexually active. But federal funds have been supporting other forms of reproductive health care. Medicaid is indispensable for ensuring that low-income people have coverage for family planning, pregnancy-related care, STI testing and treatment, and other reproductive health services. But right-wing policymakers are seeking to undermine or even dismantle Medicaid, the source of health coverage for 74 million U.S. residents, including 13 million U.S. women of reproductive age. A contributor to Forbes calculated that the Republican health bill will provide about $3 million in tax cuts to the wealthy for each person who dies because of loss of access to health care. Even if the Republican bill passes, the Reproductive Health Equity Act will make safe, legal abortion more affordable and more accessible for about 43,000 Oregonians whose insurance plans have prohibitively high deductibles. But the Reproductive Health Equity Act concerns more than just abortion, and uniquely, it includes access provisions for non-documented women and anti-discrimination protections for transgender and gender non-conforming Oregonians. It will remove barriers that hinder access to essential reproductive health care services, including prenatal care and life-saving cancer screenings for transgender and gender non-conforming Oregonians. It will expand postpartum care to about 48,000 Oregonians who have coverage for labor and delivery that drops immediately after birth. It will help almost 19,000 Oregon residents who are forced to pay out-of-pocket costs for preventive health services, including contraception, and it will continue to ensure that all Oregonians receive the full range of preventive reproductive health services at zero out-of-pocket cost, even if the Affordable Care Act is overturned. It will safeguard the right to abortion, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned. This legislation is not just a response to the Trump administration. The bill was developed, written, and supported over the last 3 years through the work of people directly affected by these obstacles to health care and through the work of organizations that have been building the knowledge, capacity, and community to develop legislation, educate voters, petition the state, lobby legislators, and get out the vote. Like the Cover All Kids bill, which also passed the Oregon House this past week, making Oregon the 7th state in the nation to provide health care for all children, regardless of residency status, and up to 300% of the federal poverty level. The Reproductive Health Equity Act is the product of long years of work on the part of many, many groups and individuals. The success and value of such legislation requires the thoughtful and long-term work of a wide and diverse coalition of activists. The steering committee of the Pro-Choice Coalition included not just reproductive health care organizations, the state groups for NARAL and Planned Parenthood, but also legal and community organizations and racial and gender justice groups, including the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO, the ACLU of Oregon, Family Forward Oregon, which works at the intersection of family and labor issues for family-friendly workplace policy, and the Western State Center, which works to connect and build the power of community organizations to achieve racial, gender, and economic justice. The list of supporting groups is even longer and more diverse, but special mention should go to We Are Brave, a project of the Western State Center led by women of color and focusing, as the acronym indicates, on building reproductive autonomy and voices for equity. Kara Carmosino, the Director of Programs and Strategies at APANO, describes the work that began 3 years ago to make the bill a success. In those 3 years, quote, APANO members and staff have supported a truly coalitional effort that collected nearly 10,000 petition signatures, gave dozens of workshops on strong families and reproductive justice, created art and collected stories to include transgender and gender nonconforming people, as well as immigrants and refugees in the narratives around who needs reproductive health care. They launched a Mend the Gap report that directly challenged the myth that everyone in Oregon already has access to the reproductive health care they need. And they built a policy and a campaign that centered the stories of those who need this win the most. End quote. Apano has a handy link for thanking the legislators who passed the bill. But as Carmosino notes, the victory belongs to many people, from those who canvassed events 2 summers ago, to those who bravely shared their stories, to those who signed petitions and lobbied in the Capitol. The importance of that wide and diverse coalition goes back to the origins of the bill and its design. Collaboratively developed to address the needs of marginalized communities, it was written by and for those who have been most impacted by the gaps existing in reproductive health care, to address the things that those communities themselves said they needed. Although some of the arguments brought to bear in support of the bill pointed to economic questions, highlighting, for instance, the fact that birth control is cheaper than maternity care, saving money was just part of the strategy. It was never the goal. The goal is better health care, and thus better health and better lives. By lifting up the voices and supporting the advocacy of the least advantaged, these organizers have helped improve the lives of tens of thousands of Oregonians and have demonstrated that the intersectional approach is not just ethical, but effective. Their work has provided examples of how to expand access to health care and has moved us closer to providing health care for all. If you're interested in working for a state single-payer system in Oregon, you might want to check out the work of Healthcare for All Oregon. They're offering a free screening this Wednesday of the video Sick Around the World, Other Rich Countries Have Universal Healthcare, Why Don't We? It'll be at noon on Wednesday at the Multnomah County Health Department, 426 Southwest Stark, in the 10th floor conference room. HCAO's calendar on their website, hcao.org, lists other events and meetings around the state. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
That come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heightened. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate. But if we claim our inaction, that's activist. Our body's not a target, yet it's under attack. Forward together, never a single step back.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. A couple of announcements for the Old Mole Community Action Calendar this week. The workers of the Burgersville Workers Union, BVWU, invite you to a picket Friday, July 14th at the Burgersville on Southeast 92nd and Powell. Come have some fun while standing in solidarity with Burgersville workers against hate speech, intimidation, and Burgerville's union-busting tactics. Meet at the a Park and Ride at 3618 Southeast 92nd Avenue at 5:30. From there, you'll march to the Burgerville on 92nd and Powell. The NAACP Portland branch is hosting a two-day event called Freedom Summer 2017. Our community, the NAACP says, needs healing and an ability to come together and develop skills that allow us to rely on our faith and our community in these political times. There'll be workshops on Friday and Saturday, including bystander intervention, de-escalation training, nonviolent direct action training, youth organizing training. Registration is required. Call 503-928-6723 or email Portland. NAACP@gmail.com for information and details. Now Desiree Helligers talks with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
So my guest today is Dan Handelman from Portland Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, and we're talking today about the new use of force guidelines that have been released over the 4th of July weekend with a very quick turnaround time. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Dan?
Well, the Portland police have been posting their policies, which they call directives, for about 3 or 4 years now. And they normally would put them out at the beginning of a month and give you 30 days to respond. Starting this year in 2017, they started putting out a second rewrite with a 15-day window, and there's never an indication of what they changed and what is remaining the same. So they put out two of the arguably most important directives that the community cares about, which is how the police use force and how the police investigate when deadly force cases happen. On Saturday, July 1st, as you say, over July 4 weekend, with a two-week turnaround, and both the documents are multiple pages. One is about 15 pages long, and one's about 25 pages long. And the use of force policy incorporates not only the old use of force policy, but every policy about different kinds of weapons that the police use, the tasers, batons, pepper spray, and then their reporting requirements, something that's called an after-action report that the supervisor is supposed to write up after a use of force happens. So it is a massive undertaking to find out what they moved from those other policies into this policy and what's been changed.
And so clearly they just could have highlighted the changes to the policy, but they chose not to do that.
Correct. And there's software you can use that compares the old document to the new document, and we try to use that here at Portland Cop Watch, but it doesn't help when they move things around and change massive chunks of it. So the thing that people, I think, should be concerned about, and to be clear, the comments on these two policies, use of force and post-deadly force investigations, the comments currently are due on Friday, July 14. We, Portland Cop Watch, authored a letter that went out on Thursday with other organizations, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, League of Women Voters, the NAACP, asking the mayor, please push the deadline back, because this is too important to the community. And seriously, if the police believe that they are a community policing organization, why would they make it so hard for the community to have input into such an important policy? So here are some of the things I think people should be really concerned about. In the use of force policy itself, they're saying that nothing in this policy, even though there's a whole section on de-escalation, nothing in the policy requires a member to retreat or be exposed to possible physical injury before applying reasonable force. What that says to me, that's in their top policy section, is, you know, we're telling you to back off, we're telling you not to use as much force as is legally allowed under the Constitution, but we have your back if you decide to use force on somebody. And I think that's entirely the wrong message to send. I mean, we're under scrutiny. The reason that we're even having the ability to do these, to make comments on these, is that the U.S. Department of Justice came in 2012 and said there's a pattern and practice of excessive force by the Portland Police, and you have to include the community when you're making these new policies. So instead of making things better, they're sort of finding ways to sweep things under the rug. So in the investigations directive, there's a force report that every officer is required to write up if they use force before the end of their shift, basically. And the U.S. Department of Justice said in their annual reports to the Judge Simon, who's overseeing this whole agreement, that there's no exception for when they use deadly force, right? You know, they should, you know, whether punch somebody briefly in the arm, or if you shoot them, it's still use of force. You still have to write your report before the end of the shift. The Bureau's draft explicitly says that the officers do not have to write a deadly force report when a person dies as a result of their firearm until after the criminal investigation is over, which could take several weeks. And then they say that the internal affairs captain has the discretion to ask an officer to write such a report when the person doesn't die.
So this constitutes a major setback in terms, if this passes, this constitutes a major setback in terms of accountability for the use of lethal force in particular.
Exactly.
Because we used to have a 48-hour window in which they had to report on, you know, they had to provide their own account of a shooting, and now we basically, are we eliminating that 48-hour rule?
Well, that's a very good question. So what you're referring to is something that was in the police association contract that said they could not compel an officer to testify in less than 48 hours after a shooting. And this is a very complicated legal thing, and I don't know how much time you have to explain this all to the listeners. But so there has to be a firewall, basically, between the administrative investigation where they compel the officers to testify and the criminal investigation where they're finding out whether they broke the law. And as you and I know, they've never indicted an officer for an on-duty use of deadly force, except in one case where the officer actually committed suicide before it can go to trial. So, unfortunately, as you suggested, because of these complications in the law, there are provisions in the directive about investigating shootings that will make it so that the officer doesn't have to give their testimony, at least not right away, and perhaps not until after the grand jury has been held, which could be 2 or 3 weeks or even longer after the shooting.
Okay. Now, is this document coming out of the PPB or coming out of the mayor's office?
It's coming out of the police bureau itself. There's a captain in charge. His name is Captain Krantz, and he's in charge of this whole project. It actually used to be Chief Marshman's job before he got promoted to chief, was to make sure that these reviews were being done. And so they put these things out, and like I said, they used to put them out at the beginning of every month, and now they kind of roll them out every couple of days. And I'm not saying days lightly. We had at least 4 different deadlines in June, and there are 4 deadlines in July, and we're only, you know, a week into July at this point. They don't differentiate between inspecting an officer's uniform to see whether the buttons are on it correctly versus, you know, when they're going to use deadly force. And they give us the same amount of time to look at either policy. And they don't give a heads up that this is coming out, and then they say they don't show us what the changes are. So, you know, there's an incredible amount of time being spent by us volunteers going through the document to find out what's been changed.
So when was the last use of force document issued?
The last draft that they released came out in November of 2015. And we submitted comments at that time. So they're calling this the second. They have a first universal review, what they call, and then they have a second review. So the first review, you have 30 days to comment, and the second review, you only have 15 days to comment. And they're considering this the 15-day period, even though they sat on this for a year and a half before they released this draft, and they have all these things in here which are, you know, kind of flying in the face of both the community and, I expect, the DOJ.
Do you think there's any connection between the speed with which they're kind of demanding review of this document and the search for a new police chief?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it could be that Chief Marshman has ordered Captain Krantz to get all these policies set up so that he, Chief Marshman, can look like, you know, hey, I've been taking care of these policies that the DOJ ordered us to redo, and to try to secure his position as they're searching for a new chief. It's also possible the DOJ is cracking down and saying, you've been under this scrutiny for 5 years. The original document that we signed said the entire agreement with the DOJ is supposed to last 5 years, and we're supposed to go back to court to see Judge Simon sometime in the fall, and we're supposed to tell him whether or not we finished making all these changes. So it could be the city's just saying, we want to get out from underneath this thing. Let's just do as many changes as we can. But if that's the case, then why are they putting out these documents that kind of fly in the face of what they're supposed to be doing?
Okay, so this does represent a major kind of reversal in policy.
In terms of the lethal use
of force.
Correct.
And so it sounds like it's a really important time for our listeners to be contacting the mayor's office in particular to respond to this. And what do you think the best course of action is? To demand that an extension be made for the review of this document, and also a demand that we have police officers responding within a narrow window of time after a shooting occurs, right?
I think those are both exactly what people should do, right? That, you know, to follow up on the community letter that we sent the mayor asking that, you know, we have at least 30 days. The DOJ itself has 45 days to review these policies. There used to be a community oversight advisory board whose job it was to make sure that the community had input into these things. And when you think about it, they were only supposed to meet once a month. So how would they ever have been able to review a policy that had a 15-day timeline on it? And what about other community groups? Like, our group only meets once a month. What about advisory bodies like Citizen Review Committee and the Training Advisory Council and other groups that still exist that won't have a chance to look at this? So they have to extend the timeline. And while you're on the phone, and to the extent that you can read these policies, they're up on the Police Bureau's website. If you go to the City of Portland's website, click on the police, and then click on directives, you can read them yourself. Just say, you know, we want to make sure that officers have to file reports that the same scrutiny that is done for every other kind of use of force is done for use of deadly force as well.
Which is immediately following the use of deadly force, somebody is interviewed and that statement is taken in order to weigh it against other evidence that's subsequently given.
That's what happens when a community member commits a murder. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened when a police officer commits murder.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us if there are any important anniversaries of police shootings that are coming up or have just passed?
In May, it marked
Kendra James'
14
shooting?
Years since Kendra James was shot and 7 years since Keaton Otis was shot. And that month also included the second shooting of a young African-American Portlander, Terrell Johnson, after the shooting of Quantas Hayes, which happened in February. And we've put out this kind of snarky, I guess, analysis that said, you know, these shootings by the Portland police basically started up right after Jeff Sessions was confirmed as the attorney general and said, I'm not going to do any more of these investigations like we have in Portland about whether police are violating the law. He thinks that there's a war on the police and that we have to back off.
And is it accurate that we've had twice the number of police shootings this year, lethal police shootings of previous years, or at least in 2015, I believe?
It's double of last year. So last year there were two shootings and one person died. This year there have been four shootings and two people have died. And we're just in July so far.
And so coming up on Wednesday is the vigil for Keaton Otis, which takes place at 6 p.m. And that is at the corner of
Northeast 6th and Halsey. Uh-huh. Yeah, Wednesday the 12th. It's the 12th of every month. So in this case, the 12th of July. Uh-huh.
At 6 p.m. So my guest today has been Dan Handelman with Portland Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch. Thanks so much for joining me, Dan.
Sure. Thank you.
And this has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Desiree. In February 1999, 23-year-old Guinean immigrant Amadou Diallo was shot to death by four NYPD police officers after the wallet he withdrew from his jacket was mistaken for a gun. During the subsequent trial, activists, politicians, and celebrities condemned the killing and organized protests throughout the city. Responding to the four officers' acquittal the following year and ignoring censures from the city's police union, Bruce Springsteen and his E Street Band performed American Skin, 41 Shots. The song title references the 41 times the victim was shot by the police.
41 shots, and we'll take that ride across the bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret. It ain't no secret. No secret, my friend.
Is it a knife? Is it a wallet?
This is
You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Last week, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talked about border politics and the June 26th Supreme Court decision that partially upheld Trump's travel ban. And they discussed the psychological dynamics of various forms of anti-immigrant propaganda. Today, I'm going to continue that discussion. Regardless of the ultimate fate of the Trump presidency, with his nominee Neil Gorsuch, Trump has managed to have put in place a reactionary direction to U.S. politics for a generation. But resistance is still possible, according to Mukun Radi, in an article entitled Just Denied on Trump's Muslim Ban, of which I am going to share excerpts. Radi looks at the cruel and bigoted reasoning behind the Supreme Court's restoration of parts of Donald Trump's Muslim ban and argues for resistance. After Donald Trump's first and second attempts at a Muslim ban, Radi begins, were defeated by the mass protests and legal challenges, on June 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court reimposed key sections of the ban, delivering a major victory to the forces promoting anti-Muslim bigotry. The third version of the ban targets people from the same six Muslim-majority countries, as well as the entire U.S. refugee program, but now includes an exception for those with a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. The court's decision that the ban's supposed benefits to national security outweigh its possible harm is the height of imperial arrogance and cruelty, a message to people fleeing civil wars and sectarian bloodshed that have killed millions that their lives matter less than the remote chance that an American might be killed by a Muslim terrorist. Meanwhile, immigrants and refugees stuck at borders or in the countries racked by U.S. imperialist violence will bear the brunt of the legal and political uncertainty. Shamefully, the supposedly liberal justices of the court not only supported this decision, but also weaseled their way out of taking responsibility by signing their names to it. Instead, the court released this as a per curiam opinion, a device traditionally used for uncontroversial decisions that are so legally obvious that the justices join in their entirety. The complexity of this Democratic-appointed justices undercuts the idea that this ruling is a result of Trump's recent appointee, Neil Gorsuch, breaking a court deadlock. As further evidence that we have to fight this new Muslim ban the way we fought previous attempts, through protests that forced the legal system to uphold the justice it claims to stand for. Donald Trump and his Islamophobic allies obviously deserve the lion's share of the blame for this disgraceful ban. But it's important to note complicity of the court's supposedly liberal justices who supported the ban but didn't sign their names to it. Public accountability through the disclosure of votes and opinion authors puts the judges' conscience and reputation on the line, said then-Circuit Judge Ginsburg in 1990. Ginsburg has in recent years become an unlikely liberal cult hero, but there's nothing notorious or heroic about hiding behind an antiquated legal device. The law is not sacred, and it's not apart from politics. Overturning the Muslim ban will require a mass fight against all forms of Islamophobia, and any effective legal strategy must flow out of that fight. Organizing large coalitions and confronting powerful institutions should be at the forefront of democratic politics, not judicial subtlety and clever interpretations of superannuated texts. Durable abortion rights are more likely to be secured through a broad coalition demanding universal access to single-payer health care than through appeals to protect the legacy of Roe. The reform of racist and violent policing through judicial interpretations of the Fourth Amendment is meaningless in the absence of the political will to bring paramilitarized cops to heel. Confronting patterns of gross inequality with respect to gender and sexuality is a project best pursued through intersectional alliances, not disputes over constitutional doctrine. It was mass protests at airports across the country that turned the tide against Trump's first attempt at an Islamophobic travel ban. The fight against this new ban may require new tactics and longer-term organizing, but it still requires the same outpouring of grassroots solidarity and popular resistance to fight this gross injustice that has now been upheld by the highest court in the land. I've been reading from an article entitled Justice Denied on Trump's Muslim Ban by Mukund Radhi. The complete article, and it's quite long, can be found on the Socialist Worker webpage. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political life that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new world order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives with an ecologically sustainable environment. From the Mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Now stay tuned at 10 on Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein talks to Eric DePlatz of Seattle's Sightline Institute about Northwest communities under threat from dirty energy development. At 11, it's Health Watch. Dr. Tom Messenger discusses Lyme disease and the neuropathic approach to treatment. And at 11:30, Intersections Radio welcomes author Sandy Menon and her book, When Dimple Met Rishi. And thank you to KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.